Brian Reisman here, host of Side Jams, a proud member of the Pantheon Podcast Network. I'm here to let you know that, as you're going to find out in the intro, this is also going to be my first video podcast. So starting with episode 56, featuring Andy Biersack from Black Veil Brides, there's going to be a video component to the show as well. You can continue listening to the audio-only format through Apple Podcasts, iHeart, Spotify, or whichever streaming service you prefer. If you want to watch it on YouTube, you can look for Side Jams with Brian Reisman there, or go to the Pantheon Podcast channel on YouTube. They'll be sharing my videos there as well. Further, I have new theme music, Rookie of the Year by Bobo Renthley. I licensed the track through Soundstripe, so I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for listening and your support. I have a lot of exciting things coming up. Hey everybody, it's Brian Reisman, host of Side Jams, welcoming you to the first video podcast of the series. For those of you who are new to the Side Jams world, I interview musicians about their outside passions and their hobbies. My guest for this episode, Andy Biersack, frontman for Black Veil Brides. They have a new album out called The Phantom Tomorrow. It's a cool concept record that made my top 10, so please check it out. Also, there's going to be a comic book adaptation of the album coming that was written by Andy. Fans know that he also penned the graphic novel The Ghost of Ohio a couple of years ago that came out through Z2 Comics, and they know of his adoration for the character of Batman, or The Batman, depending upon what you want to call him. That's going to be the title of the next movie with Robert Pattinson next year. This episode, we're going to get into all things Batman. Andy's going to talk about his favorite iterations of the character, the artists he prefers, the storylines that he likes. He dressed up as the Caped Crusader as a kid and got into the animation, the comic books, the movies, the collectibles. He even got to voice Batman for a recent DC Comics animatic. Now, if you like what you see in here, please click on that subscribe button down below so you can keep apprised of future episodes. I'm going to be taking the previous 55 audio-only episodes and bringing them onto YouTube as well. You can also keep up with Side Jams on your socials, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But now, it's time to sit back and take a deep breath, because we're about to dive deep into Andy Biersack's obsession with the Batman. So hey everybody, this is Brian Reisman with Side Jams, here with Andy from Black Veil Brides, doing our first video podcast.
The very first one.
The very first one, so this is the great experiment.
Thank you so much for having me on the inaugural video podcast. Would that I could say I'm in a better situation, but I'm in a hotel room in Idaho right now, so I don't have quite the collection going. Normally, when I do these interviews, I'm at home in my studio. I'm full of fanboy comic book paraphernalia, so we'll have to just imagine it today.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got, you know, I got a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, I have a friend of mine that bequeathed a lot of Batman stuff on him. I read Batman Holy Terror. I don't know if you've seen this one, actually.
I have not read it, but I've been recommended it a number of times.
Yeah, it sort of takes place in a future world where I guess Oliver Cromwell had survived, and basically the Church of England is still very strong. And Bruce Wayne is actually a priest. He's about to become a priest. He goes into an alternate reality where he finds out his parents were murdered and decides to avenge them. So he becomes the Caped Crusader, but also is a priest. It's like a very interesting theological twist on The Dark Knight.
And that's why so many people have recommended it to me, because there's two things I love. It's Batman and overt theology. So those are some of my favorite subjects.
Well, in a way, Batman is kind of like your big icon, isn't he?
Yeah.
It's like the Church of Batman where you are, or the altar.
Certainly. I mean, I think, you know, people look to, and this is not to be glib or to be dismissive of any kind of religion, but for me, as someone who's non-theistic, I had these heroes like Batman who, as a reference point for, parables or tales of how to live your life. Mm-hmm. The thing that impacted me the most as a kid was create something more of yourself. Even if you're afraid, even if people don't respect you or like you or make fun of you, make something that you're really proud of and wear that outside so that you can eventually become that thing that you want to be. So as a teenager and as a kid growing up, it was, you know, wearing my misfit shirts and eyeliner and everybody's throwing stuff at me and making fun of me at school in Ohio. I felt like that was my bat suit. You know, that was the thing that, regardless of what anybody else thought about it, that was how I projected myself to the world. And that was my, you know, giant cape and pointy ears. It was the thing that I thought, I don't care if they're freaked out by me or whatever it is, I'm going to use this as my iconography, the way that I see the world. And so, you know, in many other ways, just the self-belief, the idea of making something out of yourself, not having superpowers. I was not born with a beautiful singing voice. I never opened my mouth and sang in a beautiful soprano voice or a tenor voice. But I figured I could teach myself how to do something that I liked the way it sounded. And I didn't need superpowers to do that. So there's many, many ways that that character has been influential.
So how old were you when you first discovered Batman? What was your first exposure?
I think I was probably 3. And it was Batman the Animated Series. It was kind of an amalgam of a bunch of stuff. Batman the Animated Series had just started airing on Fox, and it aired at nights. And my dad, my mom often worked nights, and my dad worked during the day. So a lot of times I'd be home alone with my dad at nights. And we would watch that. And then he got a VHS copy of the Adam West Batman movie. The series wasn't available commercially for years and years, but the
movie. Yeah, I remember. Yeah.
And then right around that time is when, Batman Forever came out about a year later. And by the time Batman Forever came out, I was just fully invested. I had watched the first two Keaton movies a billion times each and, you know, had worn out the VHSs. So by the time I was 5, I was completely and utterly obsessed with the character and was dressing like Batman. Every day I get home from school and put on my makeshift bat suit and walk around the neighborhood every day. It was also around the same time that I discovered Kiss and Gene Simmons was so Batman like that. It was just like, those were the two sides of the coin of Little Andy was Gene Simmons and Batman.
Yeah. I think Gerard Way said this to me a few years ago when we did an interview about rockers working on comic books. And he mentioned how a lot of the DC heroes are like gods. Superman, yeah. Wonder Woman, Martian Manhunter, even Green Lantern, Flash in a certain way, whereas like Batman was more human. I mean, he seems more superhuman in certain storylines, sure. But underneath the suit, he's more of just a regular man.
And those are never the ones that I like. I don't like Batman in the Justice League. I don't think it ever makes sense. You know, for me, it's never good to point out the fact that he is useless to the gods around him. You know what I mean? He works, in my opinion, he works best on his own as a character.
Yeah.
Because you're right, the rest of the DC universe are these mythological creatures that have all otherworldly powers. And he's not Tony Stark. He doesn't have tech that also makes him, at least in stories that I like, tech that also makes him a god. You know, he is more often than not in Justice League stories, the like wise, kraken, like angry guy. And it seems sort of useless.
That's a great way
to put it. You know what I mean? So I always like him on his own in most cases. Because you're right, it's a human character. And I even like, you know, it's sort of funny, my entry point into the comics was not Bruce Wayne as Batman. The first Batman comic book I got as a kid was the first issue of Jean-Paul Valley, Azrael, taking over the cape and cowl and becoming Batman when Bane had broken Batman's back.
Mm.
And his story was very interesting. He was in a religious cult. He was kind of nuts. He was someone who made a crazy suit that had knives and he would kill the villains rather than just putting them in Arkham Asylum because he said, after all these years, why do you keep giving these villains all these chances? You put them in this place and then they break out right away. And it was, you know, in retrospect now, people didn't like that version of the character and I can understand why, but it really fascinated me. Yeah. And by the way, you know, it's not people look at that version of the character as being illegitimate. It was Denny O'Neill who wrote the story. This is really high quality Batman writing. It just wasn't what people wanted at the time. I think it would work better now because people are more accustomed to Elseworld's story. But this was directly in the official Batman canon. So people got mad about it. It only lasted like 6-8 months. But the whole Nightfall, Night Quest, Night's End storyline is still one of my favorites ever.
Yeah, this Holy Terror thing is another one of the Elseworlds thing. It's just a one shot. It didn't go much beyond that. Yeah, when it started out too, I started reading some of the original comics, and it's like Gotham was actually called New York. I was like, they didn't actually make that distinction. So you have Gotham and Metropolis, which are both basically New York, but
yeah. And Batman in the earliest comics drove the same car that Bruce Wayne drove, inexplicably red convertible.
Isn't it funny how like you look at that stuff back then and how things sort of gradually evolved, and then. And also, I think by the 80s, when Frank Miller took over, then it started to take a different turn. I mean, I actually like a lot of the 70s detective comic stuff. They're almost like gothic murder mysteries, a lot of them.
Batman Year 2, a lot of those storylines where it is a detective mystery. And Batman is more famously the year two stuff. He wields a gun and he's basically like a, you know, a CSI detective in a blue tights, you know, a gray tights with a blue cape.
We're speaking of him being sort of not a superhuman. I found a couple issues of Detective Comics from the 80s and found him randomly at two stores. So this is, I think, 596 and 597. So this is back in the 80s. And he essentially, they're a little shiny there. So essentially, he gets caught up in this very small crime ring where these guys are doing what was happening on YouTube a few years ago, where they're taking a camcorder and going around and beating people up on camera. And so he tries to stop. He stops these guys from doing it. And then they hire this guy who's huge. He's like Lou Ferrigno, you know, or Arnold Schwarzenegger. And they get him to get beaten up on camera and he has to track them down. And it was interesting, actually. I guess he goes through these phases. I'm curious. I was thinking about that. What have you thought of all the, I mean, DC's been doing a ton of rebooting over the last decade. And there's been a lot of different versions of the character and then Joker and the different origins. Well, how have you felt about all that stuff going on?
I enjoy it because I think that it's a good idea to reset some of these characters sometimes. You know, there are decisions that are made in the canon that are sometimes regrettable. I mean, a lot of people didn't love Barbara Gordon's plight over the last 30 years. And so to be able to reset some of these characters and give them a new chance within the main canon, I think is important. You've got characters that have been in continuous publication for 80 years. You can't just keep going down the storyline forever. So some stuff works. You know, I didn't love the Death of Batman storyline. I liked a lot of the New 52 stuff. I liked a lot of the Rebirth stuff. You know, it really, for me, I'm anymore because my life is not in a situation where I can often just sit and read the books. I'm often reading on the DC Universe app or on my iPad or whatever else. And I try to keep up with stuff. Right now, I'm really enjoying the Batman 89 series because I just am such a fan of the Burton universe. So to have essentially a new movie in the Burton universe in comic book form has been a lot of fun.
And then, of course, the movies are entirely, I mean, you're talking about you discovered the Adam West Batman, which is what I first saw as a kid. And I got into it. Then as I get older, it is definitely funny in a kitschy sense.
You didn't know that when you were a kid, just like me. I had no idea watching it that it was satire. But now as an adult, you can enjoy it for different reasons because it's genuinely funny. And the funny thing about it is it's pretty biting and ahead of its time in a lot of ways. You got to think about this. It's 1966. You know, television was, in many ways, much more clean cut and less sardonic. And you've got characters like Vincent Price playing Egghead that is very, very kind of sardonic and quippy and in ways that you weren't seeing reflected in other forms of media at the time.
Well, also, I think there was a pilot or they had a trailer, a teaser for a pilot. I think it was actually a Batgirl or Batwoman series back then that just didn't go, they didn't go through. There's a lot of things they tried in different ways. Yeah. It was very hard. I mean, in the 70s, like there was a great Doctor Strange movie in the 70s. It just didn't, that was actually very horror oriented and it didn't get that much play. And I wish it had because the Lou Ferrigno, Bill Bixby, the Hulk was good for what it was. But it was interesting how actually back in the day, DC was ahead of the game on the movies. And then Marvel was behind in the series. And then it kind of flipped where like DC kind of took over television. And then Marvel was big in the movies.
Well, I mean, and a lot of that comes down to Superman being the juggernaut that it was, the first Christopher Reeve Superman, and then basically Michael Uslan and several others buying the Batman property and taking it to Warner Brothers and saying, hey, you've got this big hit with Superman, let's try to get this going. And I think it took nearly 10 years of development for them to even get that done, where the first Batman movie came out. There were many different iterations, and the movie was almost made with Bill Murray as Batman, and it was going to be another sort of 60s spoofy type thing. So the trajectory of Batman on film is in its own right incredibly interesting. And there's some documentaries, like, you know, you'll see special features type stuff, but I'd love to see a really comprehensive documentary about from the mid 70s, basically through the end of the 90s, that whole journey of Batman on film is pretty crazy.
Well, also because, you know, Burton took it more seriously. He had this dark sense of humor. Clearly he's always had that, but then Schumacher was putting it more into camp territory after a while. I mean, I think he was trying to find, but from what I understand, he actually had a different version that he wanted to do, but the studio just really didn't want to do it. I think he wanted
the Red Book version. Supposedly, it exists of Batman Forever, and I mean, the reality is, he had a mandate from the studio. It's pretty well documented that, particularly by the second one, you are making commercials for toys.
Yeah,
and if that's your job, you've got to do the job. I think a lot of people are unfairly critical of Joel Schumacher. And I think in retrospect, people hate on those movies because they maybe weren't the age for it. But I can tell you, in 1995, I was about to turn 5 years old, and Batman Forever was the greatest movie I had ever seen in my entire life.
Oh, of course, and, yeah.
You know, I was the right age for it, you know. So it's all about where your entry point is. By the time Batman Begins came out, it was the right thing. It needed to happen. But I do think that those movies are sometimes maligned in ways that are re-remembering history to make fun of something.
Well, Joel Schumacher, I did a commentary for Flatliners that's coming out in a few months. And it's interesting because I think you look at Lost Boys, you know, Flatliners, and he did Dying Young. He did Falling Down. I think Schumacher was more of a serious filmmaker than a lot of people think. You know, they look at
and his stuff skewed darker too. You know, all those things you just listed are very dark films in their own way.
Oh, absolutely. And I love that stuff. I mean, I think that's why for me, Batman is more intriguing. I love the first Wonder Woman movie. That was fun. The new one I was a bit mixed on. Although I love the fact that it's an homage to the Richard Donner Superman series very clearly. But yeah, Nolan took it into a different realm as well. Did you enjoy that particular run, those movies?
Absolutely. I it's so bizarre because Christian Bale is not my favorite Batman. I don't really like the suit, but I love those three movies so much as the totality of them. And I love my least favorite is Batman Begins. That tends to be everyone's favorite who are Batman fans. Dark Knight is obviously the most famous of the series and one of the most successful movies of all time. But if you talk to dedicated Batman fans, they all say Batman Begins is the best. I really think that I like the third one the most because of we go back to my entry point into Batman was Nightfall. That is the Nightfall movie. That's Bane breaking down Batman, breaking his back. I got to see the shot in a live action movie of Bane holding up Bruce Wayne and breaking his spine, just like on the cover of the first comic book I ever got as a kid. So for me personally, even though Rises is not seen as the greatest film, I fucking love it. I watch it every day.
It's interesting how a lot of times, you know, there are things that are fan favorites, and I'll go, I don't know about that. Same thing with music. It's like, I like the deep cuts. You know, I'm not always about the hit singles, and that happens with the movies. You find the movies like, well, that was actually more interesting. I'm like, I mean, a lot of people probably will never see it. It's out, but you know, like the Richard Donner cut of Superman 2 is something people were, even though Chris Prince had to do the ending of Superman 1 because they didn't have any other footage because he was fired. Sure. In that process, and I look at that, I'm like, I wish he had stayed on that series because it would have been a darker kind of run throughout the 80s. Thinking of the comics, what would be like, which kind of Batman do you prefer? Because there's obviously been different versions, but I assume you like a lot of the darker, more gothic stuff.
I'm a fan more of Batman as a detective. I like the noir detective stories. So I like, I would say my favorite storyline or book is The Long Halloween. I think that is. Mm. One of my favorite Batman tales that's ever been told. I like Dark Victory. I like all the Tim Sale, Jeff Loeb stuff. It's one of my just my favorite combination of people on books. But
what do you like? You know, why do you love the Long Halloween for? What do you love about that series the most?
It's just one of the most complete detective stories I've ever read in a comic book. Like it's everything you love about like your favorite crime show, but it just happens to be Batman. And there's all these things that unfold throughout the course of the different holidays, over the course of the years that it plays out, that are a mystery. And you want to know who is this killer? Who is this person? And it's gripping in the way that a good crime novel is.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I like about them. I mean, I think what I like is it's evolved. I think in the last 20, 30 years, it feels like early DC stuff was very plot driven. So it was sort of like how a lot of the heroes were going to solve the conundrum of the crime and the decision, but wasn't as character driven. And it feels like a lot of the stuff that you like, some of the stuff I've responded to is a bit more character driven. Yeah. Cool. Holy Terror is interesting. And a lot of this other stuff. Here's something that's actually kind of, well, yeah, I got this, this is the kind of stuff from the '70s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love those things.
Anything Alan Moore is always great.
That's true. What do you think? We sort of get a lot of, I mean, it's great that they brought Bane and we get a lot of the same. It's good that we haven't gotten a lot of the same villains. We already got Penguin, we already got Catwoman, although she came back again. Are there any underrated villains in that universe that you like, that you'd like to see on screen?
I'm actually excited that we are going to get a version of the Riddler coming up in the Batman, because I think the Riddler is a character that is misunderstood. If you read a book like Hush, he's a mad genius, and the things that he puts Batman through and the crazy concepts and ideas that can be explored with that character. Again, I loved Batman Forever as a kid, but the Riddler in the comics is a very different character to the Riddler that you see Jim Carrey play or Frank Gorshin play.
Yeah.
And so seeing a psychopath version of the Riddler, more accurate to the comics, as I believe we're going to get to see in the Batman, is exciting.
Yeah, I had a friend in college who was such a big Batman fan. He went to St. Mark's Comics and he bought the bat suit that they had there. It was like the time was like $150 or more, which today is, you know, $400. Sure. He was really into it. And he loved the Tim Burton Batman movie because he liked the fact that, you know what? It's like, yeah, both these guys are kind of crazy. Like, they've got this idea in their head of being a hero and being a villain. And we discussed that when we were just doing the Billboard interview about the new Black Veil Brides album. Like, there's a certain line that gets walked. And with Batman and a lot of those characters, there is that ambiguity that exists in that universe more so than the other ones.
And that's one of my favorite things about the Burton movies, also reflects some of my favorite Batman books, is when it is acknowledged that the person who dresses like a bat and goes outside at night to fight crime may be slightly different than other people emotionally.
You think?
I struggle with the, he's a handsome, well-adjusted, perfect, debonair millionaire. And then he also has this thing, because I know that in many ways it's throwing people off the scent. But I oftentimes think that people forget that this character has to have a certain level of uniquely tortured nature about them. And that's one of the things I loved about Michael Keaton's portrayal, is you believe that that guy would need to dress in a ridiculous suit to do this. Whereas sometimes, and this is no knock on Ben Affleck, but at no point do you ever think, well, this guy needs to put on a rubber suit. You just go, well, he's fucking huge. You can just go out and punch people. Like, why does he need to put on this suit to do something? You know what I mean?
What do you think of the casting of Robert Pattinson?
I'm really excited about it. I think, again, it falls more in line with how I enjoy seeing the character. I enjoy seeing the character as someone who is not an MMA fighter, someone who has to work with what they've got and train themselves to do this thing that tortures them if they don't do it, as opposed to somebody who is a perfect physical specimen that looks exactly like the same body type as Superman, and it needs to go out there and wear a bat suit. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It's nothing against that. It's just my preference for the character is someone who's more. My favorite drawings of the character are like Kelly Jones, the very kind of vampiric and scary version of the character.
Yeah, so I think one of your fans, and some of your fans on YouTube have said that they'd like to see you playing a vampire. So to that. So now, are there any other beyond? I mean, what kind of Batman collectibles do you have? I'm kind of curious. I had asked Richie Faulkner from Judas Priest about his Star Wars stuff, and I'm kind of curious what you collect on that.
Yeah, I mean, I have just everything. But my thing I'm most excited or proud of that I have is I have in my studio, I have screen lineage, which means that it's cast from the same mold that the masks were made from for the film. So screen lineage masks of every film except for the upcoming Pattinson movie, and I've got them all displayed in my room. So of all the many Batman collectibles, and I have hundreds and hundreds of action figures and comics and graphic novels and DVDs and cars and just everything, the cowls, because to be able to look at something that looks exactly like the thing that I watched as a little kid in these movies is so cool. To just, like, anytime I'm sitting in my studio, I swivel my chair around and I just see exactly Michael Keaton's cowl right there. It's very cool.
Have you ever met any of the actors who played Batman?
No, I haven't, actually. I don't know that I care to. It's not that I wouldn't. It's just that as someone who has acted and done things, like, the character that you're portraying is very different than who you are as a person. You know what I mean? So I would love to meet them, I suppose, but I never thought about it. I was never like, oh, I hope I get to meet Michael Keaton, as opposed to, do I get to meet Batman? Like, if Michael Keaton were himself Bruce Wayne, I think it'd be more exciting.
Did you go to any of those conventions?
Yeah.
Have you ever secretly gone as Batman?
No. I've been lucky enough to, you know, when I released the Ghost of Ohio comic book I did a number of years ago, New York Comic Con, and then did San Diego that year as well. And then I've done a handful of Comic Cons and Horror Cons and stuff over the years. And I always feel at home with those things. I'd love looking at toys and masks and other bullshit. It's my favorite.
Yeah, actually, I think I met you briefly at Paul Booth's studio. I think you had done some sort of party there, like three.
Yeah, we
three
were friends for a while. Yeah.
Yeah. Before, I think it was before I come out. Yeah, I like that stuff, and yet at the same time, at the end of it, I always like the shopping for a lot of back issues, but it can be exhausting. It's amazing if you're actually there the whole. I usually end up doing a lot of interviews anyway, but it's sort of fascinating. I mean, even when you were a kid, that stuff really wasn't that big yet. Have you been shocked at how much this has actually exploded in the last like 10, 15 years?
I mean, every year, and just coming up this week, there's now digital ones. You know, the DC Fandome is later this week, and that's a 12-hour virtual con where there's all these panels and everything. Like, it's the demand for that is so much greater than I could have ever imagined. It's just exciting to get to know that this thing that I've loved since I was literally, you know, in the most formative stages of my life is so big and so accessible now.
So I know that the new album, The Phantom of Tomorrow, is going to have a graphic novel adaptation. So who worked on that? Who are the artists that worked on it?
You know, right now we are still in the phases of kind of getting everything together. So we've got a number of different artists who are submitting different things. So, for me, the dream is always to have stuff that looks and mirrors the stuff that I was most influenced by. So I wanted to be able to have things that had that early Spawn feel where the panels are bright and the Todd McFarlane style where the line work is very stark and you've got hard edges and things are very moody, but they also have a lot of color. So right now it's more so about finding ways to build those influences into what it is.
Yeah, Spawn's having a bit of a resurgence right now too. On top of the 30th anniversary, all these different series, and then hopefully a movie at some point with Todd McFarlane. So I was thinking, is there anything else? When people come into your house and they see this collection, how do they respond? Especially people who aren't Batman fans. I'm always curious. Kind of like the people respond to this stuff here.
I don't have a lot of people over to my house who don't already know who I am as a person. So I think it's more just this is what I expected. so I would say the craziest thing I have is I have the costume for our character Blackbird that I made for the music videos. I have the new album, 7-foot tall mannequin that is dressed, I have the makeup and everything, and it's in my room lit with red lighting all around. It's terrifying. That's the thing that if anybody sees that is a jarring situation. I believe that there was a moment where my wife didn't know how she felt about it, and now she loves it as like a protector of the household kind of thing.
Though.
No, it's up in my studio upstairs, but it's like some sort of weird, you know, I don't know, Annabelle thing where as long as we don't move it, it's protecting us in some way.
Is she a comics fan at all, or does she?
She is. She loves all the characters. She doesn't have as much direct comic book reading experience, though she does read some stuff, but she is heavily invested in both the DC and Marvel universes and knows all the characters, the backstories, all that stuff. The Marvel stuff, even more so than me.
Well, that's interesting. So Marvel or DC arguments going on?
No, it's just whatever's best, you know, whatever entertains us.
So now I was going to ask, you know, there's one series one thing I did want to ask about recently, because they did the sort of the marriage to Catwoman that didn't happen. Yeah. I was curious how you responded to that when it came out.
I look at all this stuff as, you know, you might as well throw something at the wall and see if it sticks. Like we said, you've got a character that's been in production for 80 years. Those ideas they're sitting there. And of course, you've got a long-standing relationship with Bruce and Selena, so why wouldn't they give that a shot or not give it a shot or hint to it? People that react negatively to these events that occur within the canon always surprise me, because it's like, guys, shit's going to happen and then there'll be a reset of the whole universe anyway. So just like, why does it bother you? Even if you don't like, first of all, I don't get being mad about it, but I'll never understand people who are mad about it and then take to the internet to complain about it. Like, it's even worst case scenario, if you hate a storyline, it's all going to get reset in a year and a half anyway.
Well, now we have Superman is coming out as bisexual.
Like, yeah.
Today.
And by the way, yeah, I mean, that is all that. That's the other thing that I never understand is the fervor that people have and the anger that people have towards giving people an opportunity to see themselves in these characters that we've loved forever. Why not have an opportunity for someone who loves this character to see something of themselves in it? It boggles my mind that it would ever change your interpretation of the character for someone else to get the feel more close to them. There's 1,000,000,050 different iterations of all these characters. Why not allow people to have the opportunity to be reflected and to feel some representation?
Oh, yeah. With all these characters going 7-8 decades. I mean, that's the argument I've come up with. Like, yeah, you know, you've already had, you can collect all the back issues too. I mean, there's thousands of them. I mean, it's not like you're going to run out of stories.
There's a lot of iterations of all these characters. So if there's a version that you don't like, go crazy. There's 1,000,000 different versions that you might.
Well, I think part of it, and it's like, I mean, obviously you could argue we're in touch with our inner child. Like, we still love these things. I still collect stuff. I still go to conventions and I'll occasionally get t-shirts. Right. I don't buy as much of the collectibles, but I buy like a lot of the back issues. It feels like maybe for some of the older fans, they are, it's like a part of their childhood. And if they're more conservative than us, then they kind of like, oh my God, my childhood's changed. And it's like, well, your childhood didn't change because you still have that.
Because they weren't. The most people, by the way, 99.9% of the people that complain about this stuff haven't read a comic book in their life or haven't read a comic book since they were a kid, because they would know that these characters evolve. Any of us who keep up with the books and the separate canons know that there have been wildly different ideas that have been introduced in all these characters. You know, the storylines in the 70s, there were storylines where the Green Arrow is trying to get his little buddy off of heroin. Most people aren't complaining, oh, my childhood is ruined because Green Arrow. It's just the reality. Most people that complain have no idea what they're complaining about. So I think you're right. I think that, yes, you can connect it to your childhood, but like, then fucking go like the thing you liked in your childhood. Because the reality for me is I love the wrestler Sting. And when I was a kid, it meant everything to me. And I still like professional wrestling, but nothing will ever match 1997. Long-haired, fucking cool-looking The Crow version of the Stick.
Yeah, yeah.
He wrestles today, and he's a much older man, and time comes for us all, and he still looks great, and he's still out there. But I don't say it ruins my childhood because he's in his 60s now, and he doesn't look the same as he did when I was a kid. I love that, and I'm appreciative that he's still doing it. If I wasn't appreciative, then I wouldn't have to watch it, but I'd still have my childhood. You know what I mean?
Well, look, I'm a guy who argues you should listen to new music by veteran artists. You know,
absolutely.
You know, it's like in 20 years when there's more Black Velvet Brides albums, and some people are just like, well, I still, you know, so listen to some of the early stuff. I'm like,
Distortion's best record is Sex, Love, and Death. Bruce Springsteen's best complete album is Magic. I know everyone will argue with me on those two things, but as complete totality of their work, those are artists that had 25 years prior to making those records. Yes. And if you listen to them objectively and without the bias of what you grew up with as a kid, if you listen to them objectively, they're the most complete and well-done records in their catalog. And one came out in 2007, the other one came out in 2005, long after those bands and artists were well-established. So absolutely. I believe that you are absolutely right.
No, I think look at what we're talking about with all this Batman history and like all these collections that go on and on. I mean, like, they've had decades to also refine these characters. So you get things like Dark Knight Returns, and you get The Killing Joke and Death in the Family and all the other stuff and some of the recent series. And it took a while to finesse that and to find things. I mean, some of the early Batman stuff, it's fun, but it's a very different era. It feels more naive, but you weren't allowed to be as explicit as you are today. Also, it's the same thing with motion pictures. I don't think a lot of young people realize that the motion picture production code between 1930 and 1968 restricted what you could show on screen.
Absolutely. So, and the comics code restricted what could be in the books.
If you were to recommend like a series or an on-screen iteration of Batman, where would you suggest somebody younger start out if they didn't know Batman and you wanted to get them into it?
I think Batman the Animated Series and The New Adventures of Batman, those two series are always the best entry point because it's a great balance of really true to the source material version of the character and enough fun and whimsy that a kid can get into it. And I think that it is the reason why so many people of my age range love this character and what led to the expansion of the character and then what they call Batmania and everything else of the 90s was Bruce Timm and Paul Dini and these guys really nailed the character and in a way that I believe is probably the best version of the character outside of the comic books. So I would always recommend that.
So do you think we're at a point that we've hit peak sort of comic book saturation now?
I always wonder that, but I've had this conversation 5, 6, 7 years ago that, oh, we've reached the peak comic book movies. And then everyone that comes out is the biggest thing in the world. So All I know is there's a Batman movie coming out in March, and that is always, it's going to be a good year for me if that happens.
You're going to see it on a giant screen.
Absolutely. I'll be on tour, probably. Who knows? At this point, seems like it's a good bet now that touring is happening again that I'll probably be on tour at some point next year and have to go to a multiplex in somewhere in the world and go check it out.
If you got the opportunity to write a Batman comic, would you do that?
Immediately, yes. This way, when they asked me if I wanted to do the voice of it for the animatic series for Dark Knight's Death Metal, I got to voice Batman.
That's right.
I said yes immediately. So anytime, anything Batman related, I will do it immediately.
And how was that experience, by the way?
Incredible. I've been practicing my Batman voice since I was a little kid. So it was, I always say it's probably the only job that I was, had never done before, but considered myself really qualified for.
Was it more challenging than you thought it would be though? Cause sometimes you can do something, oh, this would be easy. And you jump in, you're like, oh, that was tricky.
No, it really wasn't. It was, I'm not saying it's easy. It's always to try to do a good job with a characterization of something is always a difficult task, but it was just fun. It was really, really fun.
Excellent. Well, cool. Thank you, man. I really appreciate your time.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
You know, it's yeah, I got to go through more of this stuff. I was going to try to even read more stuff. Then I grabbed you now. I'm like, all right, you're the expert. So hopefully
it's all good. Yeah. I think it went well. We got plenty of Batman to talk about.
We did. That wraps up this latest installment of Side Jams. Stay tuned for episode 57, featuring Buzz Osborne from the Melvins.